And what we're doing is celebrating the legacy of resistance, of GI resistors, and specifically the role that coffee houses and counseling networks in military communities have played in that legacy. So we're going to learn tonight about some of the role that the coffee houses played in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and then more contemporarily, the role that they played during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And we actually have representatives from the three active GI coffee houses in the world here tonight. They're on their West Coast tour, and I'll let them introduce themselves, but we have folks here from the Clearing Barrel in Kaiserslautern, Germany. Certainly from the furthest away. We have folks from Fort Hood, Texas at Under the Hood. And we have folks from Coffee Strong at Fort Lewis in Washington State.
My name is Paul Cox. I live here in the Bay Area. Tonight I'm representing Ancient History. I'll be talking about the Vietnam era GI coffee houses and movement for justice and resistance within the military a little bit later on, I believe. Not right now. Just introducing myself. Okay.
My name is Mike Kapp Schubert. I've been working with the Military Counseling Network since 2003. That's the only GI Rights Hotline branch outside of the U.S. And 2 years ago, we founded the GI Coffee House in Kaiserslautern, coming out of the Military Counseling Network.
My name is Malachi Muncy. I'm a military brat. And I also a veteran myself, deployed to Iraq twice, and
also, please,
my first exposure
please
to all this work was
right
because of Under the Hood in 2009. I might not have ever even known about IVW, VFP, or any sort of anti-war movement, if not for Under the Hood.
And my name is Alex Bacon. I'm a veteran and a military family member and one of the co-founders and directors of Coffee Strong.
My name is Luke Erlebaum. I love to have a mic like this thing. I am the former manager of Under the Hood and on the board now, and a member of Civilian Soldier Alliance, and have been working for the last 10 years to amplify the voices of active duty service members, veterans, and family members to share their own experience and withdraw their consent.
Well, good evening, everyone. I want to just start off by recognizing one of our advisory board members who's in the audience tonight, Ann Wright. Thank you so much for being here. And so before I say much about Coffee Strong, I'm just going to share briefly about how I came to do this work. I joined the Coast Guard when I was 18 years old, right out of high school. And really joined the Coast Guard because I didn't really want to join the military and was just really looking for a way to go to college. And, you know, neither of my parents went to school, which I found out was pretty normal once I joined the Coast Guard for folks in the military. And I had this kind of funny idea that the way we could change unethical institutions is by ethical people going into them and, you know, trying to have some sort of impact internally in these institutions. And so I didn't have a lot of illusions when I went in. I was on a 378-foot cutter, the Coast Guard Cutter Rush, which was based in Honolulu, and did patrols all over the South Pacific, standing up for corporate fishing rights and, you know, harassing foreign fishermen and all that sort of stuff. And on my first patrol, we stopped at an island called Kwajalein. I don't know if anybody here has ever been to Kwajalein before or ever heard of it. Ann has.
Marshall Islands.
It's in the Marshall Islands, yeah. So Kwajalein was occupied by the Japanese during World War II and was taken over by the United States somewhere there during World War II. But what struck me was when we were pulling up to tie up to the pier, I saw this naval ferry that was filling up with people who were, I later found out, were many of the original indigenous people who lived on that island, and they were all filling up big 5-gallon water jugs to take back to this island, because the island they were going to didn't have any drinking water. You know, Kwajalein, of course, had lots of fresh water. And I found out, talking to many of them later, that at 5 p.m. every night, they all had to leave the island. They kind of did the low-level work on the island, cutting grass, a lot of different kind of labor and maintenance work. And so it was a little struck by that. And then, shortly afterwards on that same patrol, I found out that many of my shipmates thought that I was gay, which I wasn't, and started being harassed because of that. And, saw the kind of level of homophobia and sexism in the military. There were 15, 20 women on my ship. There were about 120 crew total. A number of sexual assaults while I was on the ship. And also just the extreme racism, the contempt that the all-white officers on my ship held for the many low-level Pacific Islander enlisted folks that were on the ship, because they wanted to be close to family and close to home. And so they would, of course, never advance because they didn't want to get moved to a different billet, and the officers just hated them for it. So I was excited to get out of the Coast Guard in 2003, and I became a GI rights counselor right away. And as much as I really thought I kind of had a hard experience and didn't like the military, it really kind of opened my eyes working with soldiers and Marines especially, who were deploying to Iraq at that time, and just the experiences and the hardships and kind of the way that they were treated. Shortly after that, my sister and her husband both deployed to Iraq at the same time, leaving their two kids, with my parents. All I can say about the Iraq War is that it destroyed my family, in ways that is never going to be repaired, no matter how much healing happens. So in 2008, I was a student at the Evergreen State College, and a professor named Zoltan Grossman connected a bunch of recent veterans, and we saw a movie called Sir No Sir. Some of you may have heard of it. And we learned about this GI resistance movement that existed during Vietnam that clearly had a big impact on the Vietnam War in terms of shortening it. And wanted to open a similar sort of a project that would encourage similar sort of resistance to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. So we opened Coffee Strong in 2008 on the day that Barack Obama was elected, ironically enough. And Coffee Strong, we're located up in Lakewood, Washington. We're right next to Joint Base Lewis-McChord, which is a joint Army Air Force base. It's the largest base on the West Coast. It has had anywhere from 30 to 40,000 active duty service members stationed there. And Coffee Strong is just a block or two away from the one of the main gates to the base, and is surrounded by military bases on almost three sides. And so for the first 4 years of Coffee Strong, we operated as a GI coffee house. We were a commercial coffee house, but we also provided a lot of resources to soldiers and veterans, and we were a gathering place, for service members and veterans to really, gather and discuss our experiences, get resources, share information. We had a lot of veteran art shows and service member art shows, and did a lot of music and educational speakers. And we're also a place where the local anti-war movement kind of interacted with veterans and service members. And so folks may remember there were a lot of blockades of strikers trying to get loaded, onto ships in the ports to be sent to Iraq back in 2008 and 2009. And that was a real gathering place for that. We also did some other work around directly challenging stop loss and, giving soldiers information about their rights to, about how they could get around being stop lost, and also did a lot of brig solidarity work. There's a large regional confinement facility at Fort Lewis or Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and there were a number of war resistors that were, put in that brig, and being in relationship with them put us on to the kind of broader injustices that were going on in those in that brig. And so you want to go to the next picture. And so we did a lot of outreach in the early years. That's us kind of getting some care packages together, where we'd have the usual sort of brownies and cookies and that sort of stuff, but also leaflets on how to not deploy to Iraq and copies of Sir No Sir and that sort of stuff. And that's one of our other co-founders, Josh Simpson. He's an Iraq War veteran and was an interrogator in Iraq. And so we've always been very well decorated in Coffee Strong, thanks to Jonathan Matas, who I think lives down here in the Bay Area, and did a lot of murals and banners for Coffee Strong. Just leave it there. So this kind of all culminated for us in 2012 when we joined with Iraq Veterans Against the War to do a local Operation Recovery outreach drive. And so folks may remember Operation Recovery was a campaign to directly challenge the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan by challenging the practice of deploying traumatized troops, right? And so we did a big outreach drive on base, talked to hundreds of low-ranking soldiers who had deployed before, and really found that there was an overwhelming need to just have folks' daily needs sort of met, right? That a lot of these folks were pissed off and wanted to do something about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but were having such a hard time just making it to formation every day and just getting through their daily days without getting kicked out. We kind of took a step back and decided to change our work a little bit, and the next one. And in April of 2013, we reopened Next Door in a kind of new expanded location as a military and veterans rights center. And so I think my time is wrapping up here, but I'll just, what we do at this new military and veteran rights center is we really focus on three things. Can we go to the next one? So this is the picture of us with all of our supporters at our reopening celebration, and you can kind of see the services that we provide on those window stickers there. But we do GI rights counseling, which is like rights and information assistance for soldiers, helping them avoid deployment, helping them get out of the military, file grievances, kind of whatever service members need help with. We also do veterans benefits in terms of helping people file, veterans file disability claims with the VA or file discharge upgrades if they were kicked out and deprived of their benefits. And we do a couple other smaller services. So we provide those services. The second thing we're doing is we're trying to do sustained leadership development with anti-war veterans and service members and military families. And we primarily do this by getting these folks to provide the services at Coffee Strong. So our GI rights counselors, our certified claims agents, our discharge upgrade counselors, they all come from the military and veteran community. And this is one of them right here. Tom was medically retired just a year ago by the Army and is an intake counselor right now and training to be a GI rights counselor. Let me go to the next one. So the third thing we do is education. So really educating the community about the impacts of militarism on the military and veteran community. And so what we're doing right here is myself and an Iraq War veteran who's a GI rights counselor at Coffee Strong, Greg Miller, he's pictured on your left. We had just finished making a presentation to a group of young people, and we kind of told them about our own military experience for about an hour, and then they went into an Army recruitment station and asked the Army recruiters a bunch of questions about why they should join the Army. And you can't see it, but the Army recruiter is actually sitting in the car behind Greg on the left there, trying to listen into our debrief. He kind of knew something was up. But the exciting thing is that all of these young people kind of picked different issues to do organizing around in their own schools, but a couple of them are doing kind of sustained anti-recruiter organizing in their schools. And then we also get veterans to, in the schools and other venues to just really, share their experiences about being in the military and really try to discourage young people from joining. So we have now been open for almost a year as a military and veterans rights center, and from April through November of last year, we had about 800 members of the military and veteran community either call us or walk through our doors. So we stay pretty busy, and that's how Coffee Strong looks now, with our new paint and new sign and all that sort of stuff. So I'll just say, just real quick, kind of moving forward, we're really struggling with this idea of how do we kind of meet the needs of our community while also directly challenging war and militarism. Because our community kind of has unlimited need, there's a lot of help that folks need out there. So we're really going to try to One of the ways we're addressing that this year is by adding a formal educational program where we can kind of have at least, you know, bi-weekly or monthly educational nights for folks we're providing services to and other kind of veterans and military families in the area around, you know, why are we pivoting to Asia, or, you know, why are we leaving Afghanistan, or, you know, why are the special forces always going to Africa, those sort of stuff. And really trying to, you know, increase our recruitment efforts to just get a lot more veterans and military families participating in Coffee Strong. So with that, I'll turn it over to Malachi.
Hi, I'm Malachi Muncy. I'm a manager there at Under the Hood since since December 2012. And like I was saying before, raised a military brat. I sort of knew that the military was bullshit when I joined, but I joined to get away from situation at home, like a lot of folks in college money and such. I joined the National Guard. I deployed Iraq 0405. I came back, had a really hard time, and I volunteered a really hard time. I volunteered to go back to Iraq to get away from that hard time. And while I was there, I think I saw, throughout my military experience, I saw a lot of the same problems that Alex saw. Racism, there were rape cases on both of my deployments. Not caring for the people that make the thing happen, generally speaking, and not taking care of mental health of folks. It really upset me that I didn't see those stories sort of represented in a very human way at all. At most, it seemed to me that many of those stories were told by numbers or like pieces of paper, very disconnected from like the actual human experience. And that got me thinking a lot about narrative and humanity and such. Anyway, when I came back from Iraq, I got a job at a newspaper, and it was through that job at the newspaper that I heard about Under the Hood as it was opening. And it opened in February 2009, drawn largely on a history that I had no idea existed. From 1968 to 1972, the Aleo Strut was a GI coffee house in Killeen. Anybody who's seen Sir, No Sir, a great movie that we try to expose everybody we can to, knows that an Aleo Strut is a helicopter part that absorbs the shock. That's a great analogy, because that's part of what we do, what we want to do. When we think, like, creating a space for people to work through those contradictions that the military imposes upon folks and forces them to carry around, those contradictions that happen when you feel like you have to do something that you know is wrong, or you have to participate in something that you know is wrong. Having a safe space to work through those contradictions is really key. A few weeks after, I came into the coffee house, and I thought it was really great, because people were talking about the sort of stuff that you're not supposed to talk about. You know, people were opening up and to each other, and not afraid to tell their stories. And it felt safe to do that there. Just about 2 weeks later, in Austin, IVW was having a Winter Soldier panel in Austin, and more of the same. And that was how I met IVAW. In the five years now this month that Under the Hood's been there, in that 5 years, it's definitely changed over time. But through that time, we've worked with IVAW and VFP on different campaigns. I think the Right to Heal and Operation Recovery. Over the course of those two summers, and there's still work that's coming out of that in the Fort Hood report. The Fort Hood report's a collection of testimonies that sort of come out of the Right to Heal. Sorry. This picture here is from the 2012 Veterans Day Parade. And it says all of honor all who served. I don't really like the tagline, but that's what we had to put on there to get in the parade. We used that opportunity to really do something that nobody else in that parade was doing, and to question the way that folks are being treated, and empower people to know that they have a right to change it. That's the second year that we've done a major float sort of demonstration in the Veterans Day Parade. Last year, Under the Hood went through a board change over, and we have a newer board. And last month we met in person as a board. We've been having a lot of phone calls, but we met in person as a board at Under the Hood, and we looked at our history. We looked at Operation Recovery. We looked at Right to Heal. We looked at the Fort Hood report. We looked at the conscientious objectors from Victor Augusto up to Adam, our most recent one. And we made a pretty good timeline, and we thought about what the future held, we thought about how change happens a lot, how the sort of change, change is happening all the time, but how the sort of change that we want to happen happens, and how we can affect that. Looking in those directions, we sort of figured that the change happens when we meet the needs of our community, which is something that we've done through GI Rights, working with the GI Rights Network with people holding weekly ribs and rights trainings for the last 3 years, 2.5 years now. Referring folks to mental health and legal resources, and providing peer counseling for folks when they need it. And we also decided that the change happens when we shift the culture of the military. And some of the ways that we've been doing that are through paper making, making paper out of uniforms, working with Truth and Recruiting folks to make paper out of uniforms and recruitment materials, because those don't need to be out there on the street. That's dangerous. That can also meet the needs of our community in many ways, helping people tell their stories, giving people a process to work through things. Poetry Slam, we've been working for about the same time, 2.5 years or so now, with the local Killeen Poetry Slam group, who you wouldn't think, when I said Killeen, poetry might not come to be the first thing that comes to your mind, but these folks 2 years ago took second in national competition. Yeah, they beat Oakland. Oh yeah. And then also by doing art shows, and I think most of these posters here you can actually see here too, from the Just Seeds. But we've also done other art shows with local veteran artists, family member artists. Different themes that we've set that around. Drawing on the history of the Alleo Strut a little bit more. The local newspaper. Every coffee house had a newspaper. I think there might have been more newspapers than there were coffee houses. this Fatigue Press. That's the Killeen newspaper that was out there in Killeen during the Vietnam era. And we have the same P.O. box as them. We asked for it because we really realize how empowering continuing the story of resistance can be. Two things I show people most of the time is Bonus Army and Cernosert, and then Bonus Army stuff, because it's really empowering to see that you can demand your rights and that you can tell your story. But in that sort of heritage there, this last October, Under the Hood applied for a low-power FM station and just about 2 or 3 weeks ago we were approved for that. And I can get into that more later if anybody's interested in talking about it individually, maybe in the Q&As. But I think there was one question that didn't really get answered by the presentation that was already there. How has this work changed me? Is that right? Well, I'm not in jail, and I'm not dead on the side of the road. And I think that speaks to how much hope and support that this work really gives to me. I oftentimes feel like I get a lot more out of it than I put into it. And that's because of folks like y'all. Thank you.
I'm gonna stand up. just like really short, I would like to explain like how did I end up doing this. I live in a military town in Hanau in the Rhine Main area that used to be like the biggest outpost outside of the U.S. That's where I grew up, so there was always a connection to soldiers. By the time it was by the end of 2002, it was pretty clear, you know, like the Iraq war was gonna happen. So a lot of people I knew, it was clear that they have to be part of the invasion. And I always felt like I don't want these guys doing this. I don't want them to go through this. There must be something out there that could stop this or help these guys to, I don't know, get out of it. By that time, the main airport for the U.S. military was in Frankfurt, Frankfurt Air Base, and there was before the war started, there was a massive blockade from the peace movement, all kinds of people. And before the war started, you probably know that like there was like millions of people on the streets all over the world. So I went to one of these blockades, and over there I ran into a group of veterans. It was the Stop the War Brigade. There was people with the Stop the War Brigade: Donnell, Stephen Summers, Dave Blalock, people who are like in the Cyrano movie, big surprise, and also David Carson, who was a CEO during the Desert Storm. So I ran into these guys, and I was just totally amazed that there are like Americans out there, like actually, you know, like doing this kind of peace work or like work against the war. And that's how I got connected to that work. And I found the Military Council Network, what was run by the German Mennonite Peace Committee, and they started this work way back in the 80s. Having volunteers helping with the GI rights counseling. And they have been a part of the GI rights hotline since then. Yeah, so I started to work with the Military Council Network in 2003. Over the years, like around 2010, there was like questions, you know, like how to go on with that work. It was not so easy to get volunteers for that work anymore. So there was a discussion, are we going to close this down, or how are we going to go on with this? And me and my husband, an Iraq veteran himself, he deserted in 2007, we just decided we got to keep this going. This is important work to do. It would be just not right to not do that work anymore. So I always had the idea, because of watching Sir No Sir, I want a coffee house. This is cool, I want this. So we had to figure out, you know, like if we want to do a coffee house, where are we going to do it? And we had to just go to Kaiserslautern, because that's the place, that's the belly of the beast right there. I hope you can see this from far away. Probably, maybe some of you might ask themselves, why is the U.S. military in Germany still? What the hell are they doing there? The wall came down. They don't have to protect us from the Russians anymore. You know, like, what are they doing? If you're not too much into the topic, you would think like, yeah, they're reducing troops, they're shutting down bases, you know, like, what is going on there? And they do actually shut down bases, but just to concentrate people in certain areas. One thing why Germany is so an important strategic, important place, and why it's so important to not only doing the GI Red counseling stuff, but also doing like the political anti-military work, is that Germany is holding the first off, the European command is headquartered in Germany, and also what becomes more and more important nowadays is like the African command is in Germany. The coffee house itself is in Kaiserslautern. That's next to Ramstein Air Base, Landstuhl Medical Center. That's the largest U.S. military hospital out of the U.S. But Ramstein Air Base is becoming more and more important. I will try to explain why that is. We're talking a lot about the drone operations going on here in the several past years, and also people are wondering, you know, like, what's going on in Africa? You know, like, they send all these special forces, tiny little troops there, and what are they doing? So the connection here is the Ramstein Air Base is part of this worldwide net, including Germany, of the airspace operation center stuff. That Ramstein is the airspace operation center, and Ramstein they're not launching drones from Ramstein, but Ramstein is part of the whole entire process. So there's drones in the air taking pictures of, doing the surveillance pictures. This is projected in Ramstein Air Base, so they have these massive screens where they can actually, you know, like, see in detail, you know, like, the people. The air base and the Africa command in Stuttgart decides on, you know, like, is this an important person? Do we need to kill this person? And then the third part of the drone operations is some base over here in the U.S., New Mexico, whatever, or maybe Beale, I'm not sure about that, where the people actually sit with their joystick. And so all these three points work together to do the killings. So much to the importance of the area where we're at. And there's like a lot of work to do about this in the future, I think, and I hope that we can connect on this and better network, because we're all in the same shit, so to say. So yeah, Kaiserslautern, K-Town. Probably a couple of you who've been in the military are pretty familiar with the K-Town name. We have to do it in K-Town. Of course, the idea behind the coffee house is pretty similar to what the others are. But also, of course, being in Germany, it's quite different. We don't have too many active duty people coming in, and a lot of the counseling just goes via email and phone, just because people are spread out all over Europe. But we do have this space there and really try to be an open, comfortable space. We have couches and things. we do a lot of events in the sense of like doing music shows and open mic nights, but also showing movies and just in general being a pretty kind of relaxed place. Also, we have the advantage of being in Germany, so we can actually sell beer and things. So it's a bar and coffee house. I think that the nice thing about it is a lot of students come in, like German students, a lot of older folks from the peace movement come in, so there's like a lot of interaction between Germans and Americans. We have a lot of civilian workers coming in, and because of the makeup of the cafe, it's just really nice because people, they kind of have to sit together on the couch and they just start talking. And I think that's the nice thing about the cafe, that there's interaction. One of the questions was, what are you fighting for? I think the advantage of being in Germany is that the German military changed a lot in the past 2-3 years. First off, we don't have a draft anymore, so we're really going in the same direction as the U.S. military is doing it for a long, long time. Of course, there's something like the power to draft. Also, the recruiters go into the schools and all that. You know all that, but that's pretty new to Germany. And also, recently there was like the NATO security conference in Munich, and we had like all these female defense ministers or whatever you want to call them, like these five women sitting there and actually talking about, you know, like what are we going to do? And like Germany is like really out there to get on the game. And that is something new to deal with. But the good thing is, I think like the experience we have with working with US soldiers, we can completely relate to what's going to be out there, and it's happening. The same problems are going to happen to the German guys as well. Just one example that might sound very familiar to you. I have this neighbor. He was in the German military for 4 years. He was in Afghanistan and in Africa. His contract after 4 years was up. And in Germany, you get unemployment money when you work. Usually that's like 67% of what you earned. So he was wondering, why do I only get like 600 euros? I earned a lot more, so I supposed to get more unemployment money. And he went to the unemployment office and went like, yeah, what's the matter with that? And this guy behind the counter just says, well, what you were doing the past 4 years was not a real job. So we go in the same direction. And I think I have the opportunity to combine these things and also, yeah, talk, like mixing the Germans and the Americans right there.
Great.
I'm really honored to have the opportunity to be together with you all. Thank you for doing the work that you're doing. I just want to thank a couple people who are sitting out here too, who also do a lot of work. Jerry Condon has been on the tour. He's on the current board of Under the Hood as well, and so are a couple other people. So it's just really important that we acknowledge the people that do this work with us, and I can't thank everybody right now, but you know, just, that's important. What am I talking about? Okay. It's hard to like. Sometimes it's hard. I get confused about my story. You know, what am I doing in this work? I'm not a veteran. I'm a civilian. Never been subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Although when I grew up working class, and I had a lot of problems. When I was 17, it was after the Gulf War, and I decided that I wanted to join the military. So I dropped out of high school, so I had my parents sign the waivers to so I could enlist in the National Guard. And I went through all the testing, and there were a couple of steps left, like following through and showing up, and I didn't. So. And it's not because I didn't want to join the military, it's just because life was hard and it didn't happen. So I don't always tell that part of my story. I'm not a veteran, but there has always been pieces to me of like parallels of understanding how you can be in situations where you make choices to be a part of the military. And also spending time in situations and institutions that don't allow you the right to exit them if you want to. So anyway, I'm gonna fast forward. So I didn't really have anything to do with the military up until the Iraq War had started, and I was opposed to it and was demonstrating on the streets and did a lot of direct action and was like, I'm in this, I want to end this war, and did that for a couple of years, and the war wasn't ending. And then the first soldiers, public soldiers, started to come out to speak against the war, to either refuse deployment, or had been there. You know, Camilo Mejia, Kevin Benderman, done tours in Iraq, come back and refused to go back based on their experience. And so this is starting to happen, or actually Stephen Funk, the first one, that my first introduction to understanding. I didn't know anything about Cyrano Sur, Vietnam War. I didn't know that history existed at all. And until the current wave of GI resistance, in this last 10 years, we have an incredible amount of resistance that's happened in the past 10 years. We look back at the Vietnam War and much to learn and much to celebrate and draw from. But I think that we need to remember and celebrate and not forget the resistance in the last 10 years. Stephen was my first introduction to soldiers refusing to go. He's over there. Thanks, Stephen. Then the other soldiers who have been, like I said, Camilo Mejia, Kevin Benderman, Pablo Paredes, spectacular acts of confrontation and refusal. And I was hooked. I was like, oh shit, if I'm against the war and I want to end war, like, this is the stuff to do. Like, how can I support soldiers who are refusing? Because that's how wars end. It was like, oh, this is strategic. Like, actually, like, we can think about, like, how do we end wars? One of the ways we end wars is we withdraw our consent, and the military is a huge part of continuing wars. So how do we support with the withdrawal of consent from inside the military? I that's what I did. But more, it was, for me, it was that, just that it personally spoke to me. It was that work. We have to find that work that moves us. And it was incredibly moving to me. When we think about these institutions that uphold war, the military being a key one of them, it's different to be inside that institution resisting war. And it's our responsibility outside of those institutions to stand up and create an atmosphere to encourage that and actually support those soldiers. Like, that's pretty badass. But a piece that I started to understand is that resistance isn't just these spectacular acts of refusal and public acts of resistance. That was the tip of the iceberg. There were, hundreds and hundreds, and I'd say thousands of soldiers who were resisting, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, and starting to value and understand that there's a spectrum. And so how do we not only just, yes, we have to demonstrate when these very public acts of confrontation and refusal happen, there are soldiers who see that, and they also see, well, what happens to those soldiers when they refuse? So anyway, I would encourage us to think about resistance not just as those acts of refusal to participate, that, going AWOL, yes, reading an anti-war book, having a conversation in your unit, that takes a lot of resistance. That takes courage and strength within the military to actually take, what are the baby steps that lead up to actually refusing? And so I ended up Am I getting the note here? Am I going off? So yeah, anyway, tons of resistance in the last 10 years. And I think that was a huge part of how these current coffee houses came into existence, not only just drawing from the legacy of the Vietnam War, but that in the areas that these coffee houses emerged, there was resistance. You know, and we built up, I say we, a collective we, that's we too. I know you're Faye, a lot of y'all have been doing this work for a long time. You know, in those areas through supporting resistors, we are telling the story of like how in the Vietnam War, soldiers played a part in ending that war. That's true, you know, sure. We can't just glorify and like not look at other factors, but like it's absolutely true that the military became unreliable and that helped end the war. You know, when Lieutenant Aaron Motato refused in 2006 up at Fort Lewis, man, the Northwest, they organized and it was a tremendous amount, right? Like that's how GI resistance started to become on the map. Before that, I do want to note though, there are a lot of resistors that were not officers that have refused before that, that had gone to Canada, that had publicly spoken out, that had, you know, and yes, so when an officer did it, it was a little bit more interesting to people. That's a little fucked up, but you know, hey, it was a moment in our movement, and it happened, and it really catalyzed people. It took it out of just the anti-war movement and sort of put the spotlight on that there were actually soldiers who were refusing. And anyway, my point was that all this is the groundwork of like Coffee Strong coming into being, you know, then conditions later on, multiple deployments. You know, Under the Hood was founded from that community, much like Coffee Strong, you know, military. I also want to say that resistance is not all about soldiers. There are military family members that have been a huge part of supporting, creating resistance in the military. You know, spouses aren't subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But I think that's a little blurry. You know, they're, you know, as Adele has talked a lot to me about, you know, seeing her mom, she was growing up, like really recognizing that spouses provide a lot of labor to the military. It's unpaid, unrecognized, and yes, they're not officially subject to the UCMJ, but come on. I mean, there's a whole, family members are in this institution as well. They're just not recognized a lot, and I just want to make sure that that's acknowledged. And the resistors that I worked with, it was the family members. They were the ones who were, you know, driving the support campaign and speaking out, and even down at Fort Hood, I mean, there were spouses who, after their, you know, their husbands had done multiple deployments, 3, 4, 5. We're like, they're not okay. You know, we're gonna, no, like this is not, we won't allow this to happen anymore to us. So to me, that's like building power. It's that it comes from the community most affected, and they're the ones who demand the changes that need to happen. So for me, you know, I had come into this work through like resistance, like really, you know, people publicly speaking out, refusing, and then, you know, through as the years have gone by, I've been incredibly changed and moved more so, well, it's hard to quantify, but differently to be at Under the Hood, to actually meet people where they're at before they're public resistors. Maybe they never will be. But how do we cultivate and appreciate those contradictions that Malachi talks about, right? That's a lot to hold. Under the Hood, Coffee Strong, the Clearing Barrel, they're containers to hold these contradictions and allow for transformation to happen. Because that's what we're working for, right? We're working to transform our society, right? Well, and bring it down to smaller pieces, we're looking to transform the military. Like, well, that's a process, and everybody's process is different, but how do we create those conditions? How do we foster them? How do we encourage them? And then, you know, realize that we can organize together for collective transformation, but the individual transformation has to happen. And that's an ongoing process. So how do, you know, we need to support and embrace and allow that individual transformation to unfold. So for me, to have been a part to witness transformation happening and be part of that transformation was incredibly powerful. What I think we need to think about as allies, not veterans, not subject to the UCMJ, and maybe not military family members, not in part of a military community or directly impacted by that, is how do we support and uplift developing that leadership, like Adele mentioned earlier. Like, these coffee houses, they're not just like come and hang out. It's about how do we build skills of people to become part of this movement. So I think that we need to think about a long-term vision. Like, I mean, we need money, that's what we need. But none of the coffee houses in the Vietnam War were open more than 4 years, I believe. Is that accurate? Can anybody say it differently?
Six.
Shelter House was 6. Damn, that blows my little pitch. Most of them didn't last for more than 4 years. The current coffee houses, I'm sorry, I'm gonna wrap it up. Current coffee houses, Coffee Strong Under the Hood's going to 5. I'm sure that the Clear and Barrel is gonna make it to 5. Like, we can learn from the past, and like, we can actually think about our work not just during wartime. What would it mean to actually stay in a community, to like have these centers of resistance, have these community centers, these spaces that allow for contradiction and transformation that add up to collective transformation, and actually withdraw consent for the military, 15, 20 years, that we don't leave. I don't know, imagine that. I think we can do it.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of what we really need to build up in order to continue resistance against militarism, in my mind, is really allowing our anti-war veteran community to survive. I mean, I think that at Coffee Strong, I mean, I don't know if this is an accurate statistic. I've often heard it, a quote about, at some point in the late 70s or early 80s, the number of veteran suicides surpasses the number of service members who die in Vietnam. Does anyone know that statistic off the top of their head? I know there's a date somewhere in there.
It's December 2012.
It was in 2012.
That more combat Vietnam vets died in suicide than died in the war?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was December 2012.
Okay, yeah.
So it might have been 11.
Yeah, and I think that we look around at folks who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and actually people who never served in combat, who were traumatized by fellow service members in the military itself. And we know if we don't build organizations that are going to allow these folks to just live, that we don't have even the possibility of sharing these people's voices. The next time that a president wants to occupy a country with 100 or 200,000 service members. So I'll pass it on from there.
Yeah, and I think skills and resources that need to be developed to continue GI resistance. I think, those sort of systems of self-care and popular community education, like educating ourselves and building that resilience. The military right now is really discarding a lot of folks, and those folks that are being discarded oftentimes end up in a place where future resistance to any other thing that comes down the pipe is not possible, because you're homeless, because you had dishonorable discharge, and you can't get help because the VA won't help you. And so I think making sure that folks are aware of their rights right now, and helping our communities, our military communities, with that. Help them not be discarded. Enables, in many respects, resistance to go on in the future, and also taking that knife out of somebody's back, the knife that the military put in somebody's back, taking that out also helps really build strong allies. And some of the people I know who who do the most, have been through, have really been, yeah. So yeah, those, yeah.
You know, I think that in addition to teaching people about how they can survive under the UCMJ, teaching them how they can both use their rights to organize within the military, those are all important. But there's another thing that these coffee houses can do, which is to encourage people to get the fuck out. You know, and yeah, you can survive. I saw a movie a few years ago, and it was a picture of a RIA lecture. You know, they had all these poor schmucks in a room, and these three lifers were just haranguing them. You know, you've been in the Army for 4 years now. You're not 18 anymore. You can't move back home and live with your mom and your dad. You know, and really haranguing these guys to do that. And some of them were buying and were re-upping. But the interviewed one guy goes, you know, my mom would love to have me live in the basement for a little while. And, you know, or maybe that's not the case. Maybe your folks don't want you back. But, you know, you can get out of the military and you can survive and that'll be fine. You can come to work at the Clearing Barrel or off Coffee Strong or whatever. I mean, you can get out and you can do just fine outside of the military. And that's a thing that it just encourages mental health, which the military is not all that good at. So,
did everybody get to answer? No. Maybe I don't want to. No. I'll be shorter, I promise. No, I really want to echo though the surviving. Malachi talking about, I guess for me it's about healing. We need to heal. I'm not a veteran. I think that I'm also impacted though by working right in the community. But we need to heal, and we need to. I think as those like allies, allies a verb. Allies not like, oh, I support you. As allies, as active allies to veterans and military family members. Speaking from that perspective, my own, I think we need to look at like what has worked. What kinds of educate ourselves, look at models, what does it mean to do long-term organizing? Like, how do we build power and a base and, like, be committed to doing a long, slow process of spade work? And that's not always going to look sexy, and it's not always going to, like, maybe feed us in the way that we need to feed ourselves, like, oh, yeah, wow, that spectacular act confrontation. Like, yes, it boosts our morale, but we have to understand that, like, yeah, so I think that we need to be committed and understand what's worked, how have people built power, and that actually and have won things and be willing to do the slow spade work. That's what we need.
Oh, sorry.
So sorry to go twice. But I just wanted to just say, I think one other thing we really have to continue this work is really strongly ethical organizations, both the coffee houses and our allies. I think we really have to recognize we're working with a community that has terrible organizational experience. And, you know, for a lot of veterans and folks from the military and veteran community, they're never going to voluntarily participate in any sort of organized activity again for the rest of their lives. And this is kind of a common experience in the veteran community. And I think we really have to be, you know, willing to go through slow processes to make decisions and really, you know, recognize that how we are, you know, with each other is kind of as important as what we do and really be committed to building strong, ethical, you know, trusting relationships.
I got one more thing. Yeah, from the civilian perspective and from the perspective of in many, many years, like oftentimes feel like the forgotten outpost, I really would like to say what's also needed is people that actually, you know, like have our back, so to say. Just like people in person being there and like have our back. Because like the experience of being like the forgotten outpost is just like, of course there's a lot of veterans and there's a lot of active duty people going in and out, but like for the past 11 years I can say, yeah, you build up a relationship, but then they either go to the war zone or go back home. So it's a little bit different for us out there. So yeah, that's what I would like to have.
I got to tell you a war story. The United We Stand bookstore that I was affiliated with, a few months after I had left Marines and left Camp Lejeune and left Jacksonville, North Carolina, it only survived about 25 months total because a local Klansman decided he was going to clean up the street, and he bombed the place, blew the building to hell, and blew out windows all up and down the strip. And while the local ruling folks really didn't like the bookstore, they also really didn't like to have the strip destroyed, so they actually found this guy, and he did 15 years in prison.
I have a question about injured vets. Have you had much experience, you know, collectively with injured vets coming to the coffee houses or possibly even being in the hospitals and wanting to reach out to you? I know that, you know, like Stanford is a Menlo Park is a brain injury center for returning vets, and I was just wondering if you're reaching out to, you know, the ones who've been really injured and how they're feeling and are they angry and you know, are they part of this movement too, or you know, those kinds of questions.
I can only speak for Germany, of course. The problem over there is, I mean, we are, like in our town, is the largest U.S. medical hospital outside the U.S. The thing is, like in Germany, the bases and the soldiers and airmen and what have you are very isolated. You cannot go on base. It's really hard to go into the hospital when you're not like with an organization that works with the military. So it's really hard to get in contact with them. Luckily, we do have a lot of civilian workers that work for the military as civilians that at least pass out our flyers. So, but like a personal contact, no.
I would like to say that in war there are no unwounded soldiers. But beyond that, I would like to say yes. From the opening, many of the folks who come through there, some of the most upset people, or some of the people who are most ready to have these conversations. Are folks that have been going through like the Warrior Transition Unit and stuff like that. But also I think like, yes, clearly through the work of Operation Recovery and the Right to Heal, and I mean, you can't talk to 1,500 soldiers and not be talking to people who are injured in some way or another. And just go back to, yeah, you know, there aren't any unwounded soldiers really.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add that the Army, and I think most of the military, has a new process for recognizing, you know, service members' disabilities now that they've been putting in over the last 4 or 5 years. It's a terrible process. It takes, in the Army, sometimes up to 2 years from the time from, you know, when you get injured to when you actually get discharged with your disability recognized. And you know, the conditions that a lot of those service members kind of work under, they oftentimes aren't given any meaningful work to do. They're put under people who have never deployed before and really don't know what these folks are going through, and are, you know, just kind of given just kind of put in a corner. And, you know, a lot of folks start drinking, doing drugs, and, you know, a percentage of folks get kicked out for misconduct while they're waiting for their disability to be recognized by the military. You know, I don't know if Lori wanted to talk more about this, but, you know, another thing kind of tied with that is that's been going on all around the country that Al Jazeera just did an article on is the, you know, even folks who are trying to support, the military is trying to cut off access to civilians who are providing support to these people. You know, from anti-militarist organizations like ours, certainly, but even from more mainstream veterans organizations, you know, and you know, it's clear that the military, you know, is ready to downsize and, you know, doesn't need as many folks. And the way they want to do it is just by pushing people out for misconduct and, you know, and other reasons rather than recognizing their disabilities.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I guess I have to add is, like, just through the experience of outreach and what y'all have already talked about is that, I mean, I guess how I define it is they're criminalizing symptoms of trauma. Mm. You know, if someone can't get up to get to PT because they're on, you know, a bazillion medications, mean, let's look at the pharmaceutical industry too. I mean, you'll see some of Malachi's art over there of a soldier trapped in a pill bottle, and you saw the action and stuff. But anyway, it's that the disciplinary issues, the misconduct, are actually, you know, symptoms of trauma, whether it be, you know, even physical or mental trauma, and that's disgusting.
Other questions?
Yes.
Or reflections?
Yeah,
Gene.
So I wonder, is it for the panel, I'm wondering, do you think it's important to create, say, veterans media centers, so there's a voice for veterans, and if there's a need to have support from the community and veterans to develop something like that?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a need for that, not just for veterans, but for military communities in general, family members, neighbors, all of that. And I think, I think a lot of the radio project sort of, I think, is sort of something that we hope that we'll be able to do that, to develop a voice so that folks know that they're not alone, so that folks know their rights, and so that we can help folks develop the skills and feel empowered to tell their side of the story and be represented.